Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is Renee Garrett, and I'm your SpeechTherapyPD.com podcast host for Brainstorms, Functional Neuro Rehab for SLPs. Before we get started, we have a few items to alert you to. Each episode is 60 minutes and will be offered for 0.1 ASHA CEUs. Here are the financial and non-financial disclosures. Dr. Eric Blicker receives an honorarium for his participation in this podcast, and his non-financial disclosure is he has no relevant non-financial disclosures to report. My financial disclosure is that as the host of this podcast, I do receive financial reimbursement from SpeechTherapyPD.com, and my non-financial disclosure is that I am the Secretary of the Communication Disorders Foundation of Virginia. So without further ado, we welcome our guest, Dr. Eric Blicker. Eric Blicker, SLPD, CCC-SLP, BCSS, is a board-certified specialist in swallowing disorders since 2008. Eric received his doctoral degree from Nova Southeastern University and was trained in flexible endoscopic evaluation of swallowing with sensory testing, FEAST, by Dr. Jonathan Aviv, the otolaryngologist who developed FEAST. Eric has started multiple flexible endoscopic evaluation of swallowing programs throughout North America while training speech-language pathologists and physicians in the process. So welcome, Eric, and thank you for being here today.
It's fantastic to be here with you. Thank you.
So we have a lot to talk about tonight when looking at the role of laryngopharyngeal reflux disease. I think I got it all out in one breath. How that interacts with diseases like COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and then how those pulmonary diseases and digestive diseases also interplay with one another. So let's start out with talking about the role of the speech-language pathologist in helping identify patients with laryngopharyngeal reflux disease, or LPRD.
Well, thank you so much again for having me. And I became interested in this topic moving out to Ohio, Cincinnati area in around 2016. I was there for 4 years, and we had a large patient population of patients with COPD. And starting a couple of FEAST programs for hospitals and skilled rehab centers in that region over 4 years, we started to pick up on some trends. And I recognized there was a need to bring families, doctors, staff together to help understand the connection between this pulmonary disease and this GI condition of reflux. So we're talking something about beyond traditional GERD. Gastroesophageal reflux disease, diagnosed by a physician, is when you have the stomach acid coming up from the stomach to the esophagus. Esophagus has an acid buffering capacity that the throat does not have. So when you have reflux that starts in the stomach and comes up to the throat, that's a very different entity. Hence, laryngopharyngeal reflux disease, which my mentor, Dr. Aviv, back at Columbia in New York, has been studying for many years. So my background was there, and then kind of just landing in Ohio with this high rate of pulmonary related COPD condition, it was as if the two just converged. So the symptoms of LPR are things that we as speech language pathologists come across every day. Hoarseness, chronic cough, globus sensation of the throat, and throat clearing. And if you were to consider what would be a low level on the list for laryngopharyngeal reflux disease, many of those patients don't have heartburn because they call LPRD throat burn reflux. So it falls into our area of viewing during flexible endoscopic evaluation of swallowing, with or without sensory testing. We are hearing these behaviors clinically, the hoarseness, the chronic cough, the throat clearing, the complaints of something sticking in the throat. And then during our flexible endoscopic evaluation of swallowing, where we're looking for pharyngeal dysphagia, we just happen to stumble across swollen areas near the upper esophageal sphincter. We have foods and drinks that we're giving with food coloring during FEAS that go through the UES, the upper esophageal sphincter, And then you see them start to bubble back up and come back up through the UES. So there are clinical symptoms that we can hear in a bedside exam, like hoarseness and throat clearing. And then there are behaviors we can see with objective testing, such as edema in the throat, bolus or secretions backflow at the UES. And then you give them a questionnaire, like a reflux symptom index, and they just score off the charts high when they have COPD. And when you have this condition, we're not talking about us giving the diagnosis. We're helping identify symptoms to get these patients to the right people, to get them diagnostically assessed. And there's a void there because it's not GERD, it's LPRD. And we have such a high level of specialty training when it comes to all things throat, which is why a lot of the voice clinics in our country became voice and swallow clinics. And then they became voice and swallow and airway clinics, because we're seeing LPR patients that have changes to their voice, to their swallowing, and to their airway altogether. So it's truly a combination of just understanding pulmonary, GI, and airway when it comes to LPRD.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, thinking about me as a, when I was a brand new grad and a new clinician who went from one basic dysphagia course to immediately going to FEES training from August to December. I graduated in August and I went to FEES training in December. And I think, you know, initially I thought of it as, okay, this is sort of like a bedside swallow exam, and you really have to be proficient in like your cranial nerve exam, and you're knowing what the signs and symptoms are. And then you're doing a whole different skill with scoping within the endoscopy piece of it. And we sort of learned those in segments. And then as you're doing your training, you start putting those pieces together. But I don't think it's an easy process for most clinicians who are being mindful or really utilizing evidence-based practice in how we're evaluating what we see. Because I know way back was, you know, when I was in inpatient rehab in LTAC, we had tier one and tier two diagnoses. So taking it back a few years.
No, I know LTAC very well.
Yeah. So we had to describe before we would send the consult over to an outpatient ENT, or if we had someone in house, we would have to describe what we saw. So redness, edema, maybe some immobility or what appeared to be immobility. And we had to be very careful of how we worded that.
1000%.
Yeah. And so I think, again, that's really relevant in knowing how to provide that descriptive terminology so that you can get those patients what they need, whether it's through the otolaryngologist or through the gastroenterologist, or maybe both, because sometimes it is both.
That's the multidisciplinary component that is sometimes so difficult. A lot of traditional gastroenterologists are trained just in gastroesophageal reflux disease. And so at the forefront of this LPRD movement were laryngologists, ENTs with a throat-based specialty and the digestive specialty that really took a nice place in this whole system as, hey, we're talking about beyond the esophagus. And so they're obviously medically wise, the specialists of the throat. So that does make sense. But not all ENTs are involved in this type of care for LPRD. That's why we've got to be careful who we refer to. So in our regions, we have to look for physicians that are able to assist with these types of patients. And it's not universal. So
yeah, the voice and swallowing folks here locally are different than the people who deal primarily with, you know, putting tubes in babies' ears or toddlers' ears.
Yes.
Yeah, again, I think that's maybe if you haven't been in the FEES world, you may not know that.
Correct.
I think we sort of generalize about the specialties and we don't realize that there's subspecialties within the specialty. So I think that's a great point. And then thinking about like with FEES and then also, you know, I didn't get trained in FEES, so I didn't do the sensory component as far as the level of training that you did. But I think that's still relevant to what we want to talk about tonight. So can you kind of talk about that endoscopic information we might see on fees, but then can we kind of caveat onto if you did, do you do fees training or fees evaluations for these patients? And if so, how does that sort of differ, or what kind of extra information does it provide?
Sure. So FEES, flexible endoscopic evaluation of swallowing, and then FEES, you're adding FEES with sensory testing. Now, just to touch on that, it is still being done, FEES with the ST, and it's still being researched as recently as 2023. But we've known back when I was at Columbia Presbyterian getting my training back 24 years ago, Dr. Aviv came out with what I would call a seminal study. It's a foundation, groundbreaking study that still is relevant to our practice today. Sensory testing in the throat with patients who had LPRD, who had edema in the area of the arytenoid cartilage, were noted to have sensory loss. You're trying to stimulate the internal branch of the superior laryngeal nerve with air pulse testing to trigger a laryngeal adductor reflex response. It's a brief brainstem controlled adduction response that includes the true vocal folds in the arytenoid cartilage. So he showed back 24 years ago, this is an MD who is very speech friendly, collaborative, in his cohort of patients who were sensory tested, more than half had severe sensory loss in their throat. The ones with reflux, 18 of the 35 patients with LPRD had severe sensory loss in the throat. And that is a group where if you treat the reflux, you may see improvement in less edema. You may see patients who have improved sensory testing scores. So that research has been followed up upon in 2012. And 2014, there were a group of researchers who did this sensory testing on patients, ironically enough, with COPD. And so they did this FEES with sensory testing, and it was done by Clayton et al., C-L-A-Y-T-O-N et al. So they looked at this in 2012. They took 20 patients with COPD, 11 control patients. Granted, not the largest sample size, I understand, but they, between 40 and 80 years old with a COPD diagnosis, they were not an exacerbation of COPD, so they weren't in a flare-up. These patients did not have neurologic disease, and they did not include patients with a diagnosis of GERD in the study. Interestingly enough, in that study in 2012 by Clayton et al., 19 out of 20 patients with COPD demonstrated impaired sensory perception during FEES with sensory testing. And they said this could be significant for those with COPD because they could potentially be greater hospitalization because of lower respiratory tract infection, incidence of complications of COPD secondary to the sensory loss. They talked about sensory loss, not just from reflux, but other factors like inhaled corticosteroids and active smoking as a factor with edema in the throat, but also thinking about reflux up into the throat. So we talk about smoking. Smoking is one of the primary factors in the development of COPD. Cigarette smoking also helps loosen the lower esophageal sphincter to make reflux worse. So then you have the research with Clayton et al. In 2014. And in 2014, 20 patients with COPD studied with sensory testing. 16 out of those 20 patients had no laryngeal adductor reflex during FEES with sensory testing. That means in 16 out of 20 patients with COPD, they air pulse tested, trying to trigger that laryngeal adductor reflex in the throat, that brainstem controlled response. And 16 out of these 20 patients had an absent response, which means they had severe sensory loss in the throat. And when it came down to pharyngeal residue with feeding trials, those patients were not even aware that they had pharyngeal residue that needed to be cleared. And so it continues on and on with the thought of sensory loss in this population. And it's something where it leads to when I moved out to Ohio in 2016, the World Chess Congress in 2016, Chen et al. Looked at 42 patients in acute care that had COPD exacerbation, which is a flare-up. They found that 14 out of 42 patients were silently aspirating their secretions. And 12 of those 14 patients had two or more COPD exacerbations the prior year. So this is when things really start to get interesting. Silent aspiration of secretions in that cohort in 2016 affected the frequency of a COPD exacerbation. The reason I bring up those studies from 2012, 2014, 2016, they all lead to some additional research I'll be talking about this evening, where not every patient that aspirates has the same inflammatory response. Okay. And COPD patients, when they aspirate, they may actually develop exacerbation of their disease and not pneumonia. And I feel like our field sometimes is chasing that pneumonia, where the COPD patients, who are very often, as we would say, awake, alert, and oriented, may not fit the bill of someone who needs a swallow assessment or even seen by speech. And exacerbation is part of the disease process. But do we always understand the trigger for the exacerbation? That's where I think we can have a substantial role in helping identify these patients. And because there's a sensory loss component, how easy is it for that to fly under the radar? You can see a patient who needs PT limping down the hall. You can see a new stroke patient who can't grasp a pen. But do you see the COPD patient who is silently aspirating on their reflux?
Yeah. Or like you mentioned, on their inhaler meds, their corticosteroids, and, you know, that's when I worked in acute care for 10 years. That's all the time. That's a daily occurrence, really, in that population in acute care. Is we see that all the time. And sometimes, like you mentioned, and we'll again get into, a lot of those patients who are actively silently aspirating their own secretions or their medications or whatever it is that they're silently aspirating on may not have that same inflammatory response and may not have that full-blown pneumonia. They have a full-blown airway reaction, but it may be something that we can sort of negate or even mitigate, really, is, I guess, a better word, that our goal needs to be a little bit more defined in those patients.
And just to touch on that real quick, with the bronchodilators, many of them will loosen smooth muscle around the lower esophageal sphincter, making reflux potentially worse in this patient population. So it's a vicious cycle. They take short-term bronchodilators and long-term bronchodilators, Proventil short-terms, Spreeva long-term. So this is part of their cycle, as you mentioned. It's part of their medication regimen. And so it's always a trick with medicine. It may help one thing, but it can impact something else.
Yeah, and a lot of those patients are the still laying on their back, pretty flat, and they're open mouth breathing, which introduces more bacteria. And then you've got all these other components that kind of come along with it. And gosh, just I feel like that was my 98% of my life. And
yeah, and so what happens with this patient population, they're coughing all the time, throat clearing all the time. They have breathlessness and secretions production as part of COPD, but they develop this numbness in the throat from the chronic gastric acid exposure. They reach that point of numbness. They're just aspirating freely on their reflux without any upper airway protection. They come into the hospital with exacerbation. So in the European Respiratory Society, Dr. Julio Sanchez Perez, in 2017, reported a higher frequency of LPRD in those with COPD and was quoted as saying that laryngopharyngeal reflux, defined as backflow, which is the term I like to use, backflow of the gastric contents into the throat, she says that that is distinct. It's very distinct from GERD. LPRD patients that this doctor is seeing have nodules, have dysphonia, have hoarseness. you're taking that pathway all the way up, which is very different. The throat has no normal peristaltic clearing mechanism. The throat does not have the same acid buffering capacity that the esophagus has. The lungs, the trachea, certainly don't have an acid buffering capacity either. So this has been discussed 2012, 2014, 2016, 2017, year after year after year by researchers making this link between the two conditions. And who's doing the most awake endoscopies in healthcare when feeding patients? We are.
Yeah, we are.
It's almost tailor-made for what we do.
Yeah. And again, I think just thinking about that whole connection between respiratory, GI, digestion, swallowing. I mean, it's a continual path, right? So we start here and we end somewhere else. And that's maybe an area when we're looking at our graduate programs and our dysphagia courses for our students that maybe needs to be, and I don't know what the answer is for that, because I know they've been revamped. We've got some excellent people doing research and teaching, but there seems to be that disconnect between what that true clinical practice is and what we're learning in school and how we can kind of connect those two pieces.
I know for myself, being a professor and having a little bit of what I would call leverage in my content, this has been heavily included in my courses as a graduate professor, in my fees courses, in my recorded courses, because I think there are some people who feel maybe that this isn't part of what we should be even talking about. But Dr. Jonathan Aviv, who's a medical doctor who helped develop the LPRD protocols, says that we should be at the forefront to help doctors because of the way we talk to our patients. We're not just asking, are you having trouble swallowing? We're going into detail about conditions. And if we can get these patients to the right doctor, you may be helping more than you can possibly imagine, particularly when it comes to COPD. Again, the most notable signs of COPD are coughing, breathlessness. Millions of adults have it. Many of them are current or former smokers. And the exacerbation is part of the disease process. When the coughing, the breathlessness, and secretions production that you see with the normal day-to-day COPD, this is when exacerbation that takes a step beyond. And with the COPD exacerbation, either they have to get managed with meds as an outpatient or they get admitted to the hospital. And so when they come into the hospital, many of them are often very weak. So if it's part of our thought process, even to consider LPRD in some of these patients, it may change the way we address our objective exam choices, which may help identify this potential trigger for COPD exacerbation. And if someone is weaker in the hospital acute care, their body's more compromised. And so we've got to look at how someone might present with COPD as a, quote, stable outpatient versus the changes that come up when they have exacerbation, the ronchi, the wheezing increases during exacerbation. Okay. We know that they're going to be potentially getting increased supplemental oxygen. You throw a high flow nasal cannula into that mix potentially. You have to consider the breathing changes with COPD. Expansion of lung volume can lead to flattening of the diaphragm, which can distort the lower esophageal sphincter in COPD patients, making the reflux worse. Smoking, as I mentioned, can help loosen the lower esophageal sphincter, but in addition, it can change the way they digest. Prolonged acid clearance time in COPD patients who smoke. There's continued connections between the two. As far as potential COPD catalysts, delayed gastric emptying, increased intra-abdominal air pressure in COPD patients from coughing all the time, making reflux worse. Lung hyperinflation, use of the abdominal muscles, making these patients more prone to reflux, and the presence of obesity in the COPD population. Increased obesity can make reflux worse as well. And just to kind of pull that all together, Goodell et al. Looked at patients with COPD in 2012, specifically at the upper and lower esophageal sphincter function, and found changes to the upper and lower esophageal sphincter in patients with COPD. And Goodell showed in 2012 that increased age, increased COPD severity, and presence of smoking and obesity were all contributing factors to changes at the upper lower esophageal sphincter, essentially loosening up and permitting this gastric acid to come through both the lower and upper esophageal sphincter. So the research is there. It's whether or not we want to address it as clinicians and help look for this during our assessments.
Well, and then you add in things like the folks who are taking these, like you said, long and short-term inhalers and not rinsing out afterwards. They're at increased risk of thrush, and then they can aspirate, you know, if they're aspirating their secretions, they're aspirating that microorganism fungi from thrush, which again can lead to the exacerbation of COPD. And all of those things, I think, you know, are really great points to point out that there is a connection between these disease processes, and we can't just continue to look at them as, oh, this patient has COPD, oh, this patient has LPR, or they have GERD and they haven't really been diagnosed fully or accurately with LPR, but they have all the things. And then knowing what those medications, again, like you mentioned, they're good for one thing and bad for another, but we have to be knowledgeable of that and look at the research that's out there for that, and knowing what your lab values look like, knowing, you know, there's plenty of free resources and plenty of free evidence-based courses. A lot of the tracheostomy companies have fantastic resources and courses. And that's kind of where I started when I, again, was a new clinician, was looking at these courses online that were backed up by evidence and had people that were reputable doing the research, and they were free. They're still free now in taking those courses so that you understand, even if you're not working solely with ventilator patients, you still need to understand what those settings look like, why it's important. You know, you have to know your setting. If you're in a more progressive hospital with great medical monitoring and oversight, then you can be a lot more, I think, aggressive in your treatment and your methodology. But when I was working in a little small rural hospital with one doc in ICU and maybe three nurses for 15 patients, it may not be when you want to go in hot and go and feed all the people.
I can appreciate that. Yeah. I had moved out to Ohio, and one of my hospitals had a large COPD readmission rate with exacerbation that was infection related. They actually formed a COPD committee. I was living in Miami, Florida, and I were working in Miami, Florida for 15 years. Moved out to Ohio, and I was in a bit of a more rural area east of the city, about 20 miles east, and they didn't have speech on this committee. And my rehab director, one day about working there 10 days, brought me to this meeting, and they had nurse. They had case manager, they had nutrition, PTOT, and pulmonology, and they didn't have speech. And they wanted to know about what speech's role could be on a COPD committee, because they really needed some minds to come together to try to help understand why these readmissions were happening. And so I had all this prior information because I worked so close with pulmonary in Miami, where pulmonary was very involved in managing the LPRD patients in our LTAC because of the COPD presence in our LTAC. So this is something I had been living. And so I mentioned I got there in 2016. So I talked to this committee just the first day, and I brought up this research from Jung, J-U-N-G et al. From 2015. And I said, are you all using the reflux symptom index? It's a simple questionnaire, but it has relevance to COPD. And then, you know, I was training the team in fees, so the reflux finding score, which is part of endoscopy, that's a bit more intricate, a bit more complex, but the symptom index is a series of questions. And Jung in 2015 showed that there's a significant increase in diffuse edema in the larynx with COPD patients with LPRD. And they also showed that the scores on the symptom index were significantly higher in COPD patients versus healthy subjects. And so when you look at the questions that you're asking 9 questions and getting the patient's opinion. I think it's a lost art to say to the patient, hey, tell me how you're feeling.
Oh, yeah. Patient reported outcome measures are, yeah, that should always be part. I mean, to me,
I don't know if it is. I wish it was, but it wasn't. And I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize.
Oh, no, you're fine. This is a great conversation.
The symptom index. They're not complex questions. And the committee said to me, you know what they said? All honesty, we don't have time to ask these questions. So it's putting a Band-Aid on a bigger problem because you know a COPD patient is going to have an exacerbation. It's part of the process. We know there's not a cure for COPD. So it comes down to one word, how it's being managed. And if you're going to have PTOT nutrition case management in this committee, and out of speech with someone who has an LPRD back. By that time, I had been working with LPR patients from 2016. I was ready to show them how I could help. And so we started using the scale. And hoarseness is question one. Hoarseness or voice problem, question one. Throat clearing, question two. Excessive mucus or post-nasal drip. Post-nasal drip patients with chronic sinusitis who are not responding to medications or surgery should be worked up for reflux, according to research. The first three questions on the scale are all talking about reflux beyond the esophagus. Question eight says, do you have a sensation of something sticking in your throat or a lump in your throat? I've had COPD patients tell me as outpatients in Ohio during my 4 years there, Eric, there's something that feels like it's constantly there in my throat. I want you to rip it out. That's how irritating it is for me. This is what they're feeling. And you'll notice heartburn is a question on this symptom index, but it's not the only question. So if a doc's only, in respect to physicians, if they're only saying, hey, do you have heartburn? Patient says, I don't think so. Or I don't think so. Okay, well, you're fine. But there's much more to it.
Yeah. Do you take Tums? No, I mean, when I eat chicken wings, I've heard that 8 million times.
Yeah. And then, you know, our field is built upon this IDDSI, right? So fixated on, oh my goodness, is it minced and moist? Does it pass the fork test? Is that soft and bite-sized? This is what is drilled into our heads from graduate school. But what I started doing in that facility is I started looking with nutrition is what's actually on the trays. Mountain Dew, bacon for breakfast.
Peaches for canned peaches for diabetic patients and not in the juice, in the syrup.
Using food as medicine, you know, we could talk about antacids, neutralizing stomach acid like Tums or H2 blockers that block the action of histamine, the chemical in the body that activates stomach acid like Prevacid or the stronger PPIs, the proton pump inhibitors that block acid production like Protonix. But being someone who you're talking to who has reflux, because I'm not just a clinician, I'm a patient, but I don't have COPD. It's been discussed in research that sometimes the PPIs don't work for those with LPRD and it's lifestyle changes. This is where we began to have some breakthroughs, weight loss, reducing large meals late at night, avoiding known trigger foods, don't lay down right after a meal, smoking cessation therapy, head of bed elevation, avoiding tight clothing around the waist, high fiber, high protein, low fat diets. It can go as far as the research by Hoppo et al. In 2011, who said there's evidence that a Nissen fund application surgery, which is a GI surgery for reflux done where they wrap the upper part of the stomach, the fundus, wrapping that around the lower esophagus, sewing it into place to create a tighter angle where the esophagus enters the stomach to help with reflux. There's evidence by the research in Hoppo et al. Back in 2011 that a gastric surgery can actually help patients with severe lung disease, including COPD. You actually see an ease of symptoms in COPD with a gastric surgery? That's significant. So caffeine and chocolate, they're not necessarily acidic, but they loosen the lower esophageal sphincter. They have chemicals in them. Processed foods at every vending machine in every hospital have chemicals in them that can loosen the lower esophageal sphincter. Can of soda, pH level about 3.0, highly acidic. Bottled iced tea, citrus, tomato sauce, vinegar, wine, rosé, all with pH levels below 4. Why are we concerned about below 4? That's when pepsin can get activated. Pepsin is a digestive enzyme, but it's also a sleeper enzyme. When you take in something acidic, pepsin can float up into the throat, the nose, the ears, the trachea, and begin to destroy tissue and causing inflammation. What about acid-healing foods like watermelon, which has anti-inflammatory properties, cucumber, which has anti-inflammatory properties? What about monounsaturated fats? Avocado, olive oil, cashews, almonds, peanuts. What about the rule of 5 by Dr. Aviv from his book, which many of our patients will follow? Foods and drinks with a pH level greater than 5 to suppress pepsin, like salmon, ground turkey, spinach, banana, feta cheese, whole grain pasta, almond butter. You can still have good foods, but using food as medicine. Tomatoes, the pH is about 4.3 to 4.9. So raw tomato is not the issue. It's the tomato sauce. Berries like red and blackberries are very acidic with a pH level less than 4. So what about different types of fruit on the tray for these patients with known reflux and these things being done? Using alkaline water to deactivate potentially the reflux-causing components. I actually had a student at a university that I work as a content expert in the doctoral program that did a study using alkaline water for their doctoral dissertation, and could it potentially ease reflux symptoms in patients? And it actually showed that it worked, and they actually made it an ASHA poster at ASHA. So there's talk of this alkaline water maybe inactivating pepsin, which was something that was important to her study. So these brands like Evermore water with the elevated pH, I have to tell you, we keep large bottles of it in our house, and I'm not a spokesperson for them. But alkaline water with a pH 8.8, it could instantly deactivate pepsin. It could. Maybe not in all cases, but the point here is that if we're doing swallow assessments and we're so fixated on determining the right consistency with our patients with COPD and getting them on the right consistency, how about we also take the same level of interest for our COPD patients and what's actually coming out on the tray? Because maybe that can also have a significant impact on reflux if we believe in using food as medicine, which I think I don't know if enough in our field are turned on to that or believe it to be true. But if you've done it as a patient like I have without COPD, you do believe in that using food as medicine.
Oh, and I always go back to my grandma. I mean, it's funny because my grandma was a high school grad. She never went to college. She was a stay-at-home mom of 5 kids, but she was a proponent of activity. She walked every day. Nutrition. She believed in whole foods and growing as many things in your garden if you had that accessible to you, which you can grow things in a pot on the back deck if you need to. Vitamins. She was a huge proponent and everybody thought she was crazy. And now we've had all this research come out about all of those things, right? So whole foods, activity, growing your own food, taking your vitamin supplements. I know I'm in coastal Virginia and we've had so much rain this winter and like every day is cloudy. I feel like I've moved to Seattle and maybe no one told me. And so I've been trying to make sure I'm getting my vitamin D supplement, because that's good for your immune system too. And I think if you've ever worked with a dietitian or even a dietitian member team, like we had a team at our hospital that were just all fantastic and just really good resources. And they were, even though, again, we were in a fairly rural hospital, they were pretty good about advocating for vitamin C supplements for people with wounds, vitamin supplements for people with things like COPD who had these chronic other conditions, digestive conditions, like looking at their fiber intake, their sugar intake, all those things. And again, I think it really speaks to people want to compartmentalize these things, and it doesn't work that way. We have to have more of a holistic knowledge. And if we're going to empower our patients to not have that readmission, we have a responsibility to empower them by our own knowledge and education. I think the first time I ever said anything about a reflux diet, and it was endorsed by our dietitian, because we worked very closely, especially when I worked in inpatient rehab in the elderly, we worked more closely as an interdisciplinary team. And they were all about like, yeah, if you want to give them here, I'll write some things down for you for their reflux diet, or yeah, they've got COPD and they have this other component of a digestive disorder. Like back then, you know, a lot of times they didn't call it LPR. They did call it GERD, but it really was LPR. But they were very responsive and very helpful with that. It's just asking the right questions and making sure we have the education and can back it up with the research and then back it up with our interdisciplinary teammates, because that's what they're there for.
I agree. I have a very similar background in my LTAC, where I had a contract for 14 years. I staffed a 50-bed LTAC in Miami, and I shared an office for many years with a nutritionist and a wound care nurse. So you cannot even imagine the conversations in that particular unit with our COPD patients, who we sometimes would call our frequent flyers. But one of the elements that we could really add in, endoscopically speaking, that I mentioned in that Jung study from 2015, where the scores were also elevated, is the reflux finding score. Now, that's a bit more intricate and complex than people doing fees. It's a learned skill where you're looking for conditions in the throat that all have one thing in common. They're all the result of airway irritation from gastric contents coming up. COPD patients have been shown research-wise to score very much more so elevated on this scale compared to non-COPD patients. And the number one component here is edema, swelling. Throughout this scale, it's swelling. And this finding score and the symptom index is subjective. The finding score is objective. These scales were created by laryngologists for patients that would come to a ENT office with throat-based edema that ended up having a gastric disorder that we can now apply to COPD. The symptom index subjectively helps me decide if my COPD patient may benefit from fees. If that patient is only complaining of something sticking in their chest, I'm not going to go and scope everyone. That's not my role. But if I can use that information, they're complaining of hoarseness, voice change, globus sensation, post-nasal drip, I can get my scope and get information. I can get them seen faster by the proper physician for diagnosis. And this article by Dr. Kaufman that he wrote back in 91 is one of the most cited articles of medical research history, and basically set the table for our talk now. How many years later? 30 plus 33 years later. The esophagus might be able to handle as many as 50 episodes a day of reflux coming up from the stomach to the esophagus without major damage because of that acid buffering capacity. But just 3 reflux episodes from the stomach up into the throat in a week can cause damage. Just 3 times in a week from the stomach up to the throat. So people say, well, Eric, if it goes all from the stomach and comes up through the esophagus, don't they have to have GERD in order to have LPR? Wouldn't that be the first stop? And the answer is no. It may go so quickly up through the esophagus and then kind of what I would call land in the throat, where there's no acid buffering capacity and there's no normal peristaltic clearing mechanism to clear this out of the throat. So you get these chronic throat clearing patients. That is the primary behavior that we hear. When I walk into a patient's room and I hear hoarseness, I hear throat clearing, chronic cough, in my mind, I'm thinking LPRD. And so when we come back to our COPD symptoms of coughing and breathlessness, we've got to be making people aware this is not part of the normal aging process. Okay. These patients have coughing, breathlessness, secretions production beyond the normal day to day. Probably 12 million or more even have COPD in the US, but probably double that amount have it and don't even know that they have it. Symptoms can also include wheezing and tightness in the chest. Now, exacerbation is going to happen during the process. That shortness of breath, coughing, secretions production reaches a level beyond the normal day to day. That's a big time variant from what we see in day to day. And so when we see that diagnosis come in, it's going to say AE COPD, acute exacerbation of COPD. And if we could just get that one phrase out there, maybe to get some people's radar up to look for those patients and start to ask those symptom index questions, I think we can actually change the frequency of readmission for that patient population if we can identify subjectively on the symptom index, objectively on the finding score, get it in front of a doctor and say, this is what they're telling me. This is what we're seeing endoscopically. Can you maybe do pH probe testing to really get a reflux diagnosis where they're medically able to participate? And you may say, well, that's a lot to ask. Well, Dr. Aviv, in our 90-minute reflux course that we did together, says that we have a role as SLPs to helping these patients find the right place to get diagnostically assessed. And part of that is how we ask our questions. Ask what your patient is eating and ask how they're feeling. And you may find that your endoscopic exam is yielding information that is so applicable to their needs that maybe no one else has seen before. Because when they get an EGD with a GI doctor, they're sleeping. Okay. When they get a bronchoscopy into their lungs with a pulmonologist, they're not eating. We share the upper airway with pulmonary, GI, ENT. We share the aerodigestive tract. But we're the ones generally not using a topical anesthesia. We're the ones that have longer exams. We're the ones that use secretions rating scales. We're the ones that are capable of seeing patients in a hospital LTAC and in some SNF the same day for fees. There's not a wait. If you have equipment and you're trained, you can go right ahead. I just think we can be of a bigger help, not diagnosing, but identifying symptoms. I equate it to this. Patient gets a knee surgery. They're at the orthopedic surgeon's office getting physical therapy. Physical therapist is doing knee lifts with the patient, lifting the knee up and down. The incision site looks swollen. It has a foul odor to it. The patient's in pain when they bend their knee beyond what's expected. This fluid oozing from the incision site. I don't think the physical therapist should turn to the patient and say, oh, looks like you have an infection in your incision site. Better go get some antibiotics. No, they should go get the surgeon on the phone and say, hey, this is what I'm seeing. You need to follow up. That's the relationship we should have. We should be aware of this connection and report on it as such to get these patients seen.
Yeah, I agree. And again, I think it's funny. I had a conversation with someone else earlier today on an unrelated topic, but we were talking about how we see some, and this isn't, again, this is not a slam against newer clinicians. I think sometimes the generational aspects of what we see, you know, even when we're treating our patients, they're baby boomers versus Gen Z or whatever. There's age differences and generational things that impact their acceptance of their treatment and their role in ownership of their treatment. And so I think when we're looking at some newer, and again, doesn't apply to all, but newer grads and even graduate student clinicians, a lot of times they are intimidated by physicians and they are not, I don't know if empowered's the right word. They don't feel like they have a role in speaking up or lack confidence maybe in their ability to say, hey, Dr. XYZ, this is what I saw today. And I think it's really worth you taking a further look at it. And I can show you what I'm talking about and you can read my report. But if you want to see the images, I'd love to talk through it. And again, I think that's something that's so important because we don't, and really, honestly, that can be across any age or unseasoned clinician, however you want to term it, because I've even seen people that have been doing it as long or longer than me who still are hesitant to speak up in rounds. They're hesitant to maybe approach the physician on the side and say, hey, I really need to talk to you about this patient for whatever reason. And I think that's just a really big area too, that we have room for growth.
I agree.
I guess I've always been sort of that, I don't know, patient advocate. You know, my dad had a stroke when I was 25, long before I was a clinician. And so I have a different perspective when it comes to the education piece and being an advocate, because I don't care if I piss you off, to be quite frank. If it gets my patient where they need to be and the answers that they need to make their informed decision and really be empowered to make the best choice for them, because sometimes the best choice is inaction when it comes to their quality of life, and that's okay. And I don't think we come to that easily either, but it's a sort of like active listening. It's a learned experience in that the patients ultimately, if they have the education that you've provided and the options that you've provided, you can give them recommendations all day long, but they may not want to do that. They may not agree with it. They may want to go sit on the beach and eat a bratwurst and some peppers, drink a beer, you know. And that's their right to do that. But having that full circle where you're involving every level of doctor, nurse practitioner, otolaryngologist, radiologist too, because how many times if you weren't doing fees and you were doing a modified barium, or you got a fees referral based off of an esophagram or a barium swallow where they aspirated like a bazillimeter, if that's even a word.
I like that word.
Drop of a drop, they've aspirated. Oh my God, we have to stop the test. The esophagram is over. Let's send them to speech. Speech will figure it out. Which again, it's fine, but you know, it's full circle.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I just want to be clear. I'm not saying as speech language pathologists that we should be diagnosing COPD. We're not diagnosing gastroesophageal reflux disease. We're not diagnosing laryngopharyngeal reflux disease. Those words, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, laryngopharyngeal reflux disease, and gastroesophageal reflux disease, they all end with the word disease, right? So I think we can be stronger in subjective questionnaires and objective testing for symptom identification to help these patients. And I did that when I lived there. And I moved back to Florida at the very beginning of 2020. And we helped, to a degree, reduce the COPD exacerbation readmission rate that was infection-based by capturing these patients as inpatient and outpatient. We talked to them about trying things like maybe not having fried foods, but grilled chicken or baked chicken and, you know, a baked potato versus French fries. Just subtle inroads, not saying we shouldn't have quality of life. Not to say you can't do things in moderation, but a little bit of an exercise program might be a good idea for more than just breathing. It could be a great idea for cardiac too. And so by helping get the diagnosis and turning them onto books like the Acid Watcher Diet, the families that I've come across that buy in, they'll come in and say, we had this delicious meal last night. We followed the recipe and we made the cookies this way with the Manuka honey. And, you know, it's an anti-inflammatory this. And we're believing in this. I feel better. And I'm still enjoying the taste of what I eat. And I think once you can show how good food can still taste, if you can just get into that part of using food as medicine, I think we can make some inroads. If we can, with this particular population, if you can work on BMI, talk to physical therapy, you can make some inroads. If you talk to the primary about what efforts have been made for smoking cessation therapy, you can make some inroads. There are things that we can do without feeling like we're coming down on a patient, having them stop their whole world as they know it. But to do nothing, we may just be, keep seeing that vicious cycle. So we know that COPD has to be managed. And I just think this is one aspect of managing that. And it may look different when someone's in the ICU with an exacerbation, that flare up, versus when they're driving up to the outpatient office and they're just in their mobile oxygen at 2 liters nasal cannula and they're, quote, COPD stable. And so it does create some differences in approach when they come into the ICU because they're more fragile. So I think it's definitely something we can increase our awareness of, I hope. And I've done it, and I've enjoyed the feedback from the families that really make the effort, because they come in and they're happy. They're liking the change, because you actually, now the new talk of reflux is that it's not just localized either. It can create a systemic inflammatory response. And so they're saying, you know what? I feel better. My breathing in my nose feels clearer. I don't have tinnitus ringing in my ears from the reflux coming all the way up into my ears. I find that I can walk more at the mall. I'm not perfect, but I don't have that same, and it's using food as medicine, a big component of that. So it's not going to be it's not going to be perfect, but it can really help. And the research that I've rattled off, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Going all the way from 2020 up to current times, we've known about the sensory component. We've known about the food as medicine component. But part of what I do is just try to get the word out there to enough SLPs. And, you know, the stories I hear back from around the country of people trying it, it's pretty remarkable the changes that they're seeing. So with this particular patient population, you have a luxury here, because many of these patients, they're awake, they're alert, they're oriented. They don't have some of the same neurologic changes that may limit some of our communications, which there's a need for us to work with that as well. I'm not saying that's not important. It's very important. But here it's, you don't always have that limitation. You have people that are fully able to understand what you're saying. Now, whether they choose to be compliant and doing what they actually need to, doing what's recommended, and in terms of using food as medicine, you can't make someone do that. And I can understand that.
Yeah. And I think, again, that goes back to that shared decision and respecting that whole Bill of Rights that was on the wall way back when I first started, that patients have the right to decline services. They have the right to decline recommendations. And even though I think still there are a lot of people who don't like that. It is a right. It is a choice. And, you know, a lot of times, especially when I would have outpatients come in for that one-time snapshot swallow study, whether it was fees or modified barium, I would always say, you know, you need to really follow up with your primary treating SLP and your physician team, because I'm giving you information based on what I saw in this brief, you know, could be 15 minutes, could be 10, could be 45, depending on what we were looking at. But I'm giving you this one shot deal of what I saw today. And ultimately, it can't be my decision. I can give you recommendations, but it's up to you what you choose to follow up with and what you choose to incorporate.
I think that's an excellent point. It's one of the most important parts of my doctoral level coursework, which I took, which was discussing patient autonomy. And so I believe heavily in what you're saying. And if you choose to follow an anti-reflux regimen, that's your choice. If you choose to do portions of it, that's your choice. But, you know, if you realize as you're following it, hey, I'm getting good results, you may be encouraged to continue it. But it is always important to remember that we should respect their choices. Maybe not always understand them, but respect them.
Well, I really appreciate you joining me for this podcast, Eric. You are always such a wealth of knowledge. And, you know, in the past, I've taken courses of yours online. And so I always value what you bring to the table and what you have to say, particularly with these sort of, I don't want to call it a niche, but it is kind of a niche. This COPD, LPRD group of folks, we do see a lot of them, but it is sort of like a subspecialty almost in my mind of if you don't know about it, you have the responsibility to learn more if that's the patient population you're dealing with. So I really appreciate that. Just as a reminder, you know, if you have joined us for this podcast and you need your CEUs, just be sure to log on to your speechtherapypd.com account and complete your course modules. So again, thank you so much, Eric, for joining us, and look forward to seeing you again.
It was an honor and a privilege to spend this time with you. I enjoyed our conversation greatly, and we think we shared some pretty important and wonderful information. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have indicated that you are part of the ASHA registry and entered both your ASHA number and a complete address in your account profile prior to the course completion, we will submit earned CEUs to ASHA. Please allow 1 to 2 months from the completion date for your CEUs to be reflected on your ASHA transcript.